This is John Rappaport, and this is the Solari Report for the month of December 2013. Happy holiday season to everybody. The title of this report is How Your Mind Creates Your Future. I've done a great deal of research on this subject over the years, and I will be commenting on my working arrangement and partnership with my late friend and colleague Jack True, a very brilliant hypnotherapist, which gave me many clues about this question. But first, I want to clear some confusions out of the way, because as you can tell from the title of this talk, quite a lot has been said about this in various venues. Buddha is often quoted, as you think, so you are. We have numerous people in the self-improvement field who talk about belief systems and changing belief systems, that your future, your reality is created by what you believe, and if somehow those beliefs can be put aside or eradicated or dispensed with or substituted for with new beliefs, brand new beliefs, then you could have a whole new future. And these and other formulations, let's call them, share an important value. That is, they are pointing in more or less the right direction, the mind, as the shaper of reality and the future. Insofar as you're not going to be planning for a future that you don't believe in, or you don't believe is possible, or that you can't conceive of, you're not going to go there. How could you? You're going to go to other places, more familiar places. And then you're going to try to convince yourself that you're satisfied with these more familiar places and say, yes, this is the future that I want, and it looks very good, and et cetera, et cetera. Leaving out the possibility that there is a future that you would want much more passionately if only you could see it, if only you could find it. I met Jack True in 1986, 87 when I was researching or just beginning to research the subject of AIDS. And he was instrumental in getting me my first book contract with a small publisher to do the book, which was subsequently titled AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century. And the purpose of that book, as it turned out, wasn't my initial intent, was to reveal to people how reality could be shaped through propaganda posing as science. How the most apparent, widely accepted, universally approved of idea that HIV causes AIDS could actually turn out to be a massive mass delusion, and how this came about, how it was fabricated in research laboratories, how the science was defrauded by certain researchers, and so on. And when I had finished the book and spoke to Jack about it, he said, well, you know, this is a lot like hypnosis. People are hypnotized into accepting certain things, and, you know, then they live their lives according to what they accept, and there it goes, you know, all the way into the grave, eventually. So then we began to talk about his practice as a hypnotherapist and what he had discovered. There were two phases to that career of his. He died in the 1990s. The first phase was everything that he learned from working with private clients, doing hypnotherapy, putting people in a light trance, and doing certain forms of hypnosis. Even then, his strategies were radically different from most hypnotherapists. But then the second half of his career came after he decided that new patients were walking to his office, into his office for their first session, and they were already hypnotized, as he put it to me. He said, they're already in a trance, so what am I going to do? Put them in a deeper trance? And I asked him what he meant by that, and he said, well, I don't mean that they're walking around looking like zombies, although sometimes you'll see a certain glazed over expression in people's faces out there, but in a core part of their consciousness, they're asleep. And in that core, they remain passive and accepting of realities that are promoted and propagandized upon them. And they live their lives more or less within those parameters. So that discussion turned into, I don't know, 100 conversations, many of which were actual interviews that I have published in my collection called The Matrix Revealed. You can read about that at my site, nomorefakenews.com. And here is one of the things that Jack discussed with me about the human mind. He said, look, when I used to hypnotize people on a regular basis and in various ways ask them to report to me what it is that they're seeing in their own minds without making any suggestions of any kind to them, I would get, you know, radically different answers, radically different imagery, all sorts of different responses from patients. It wasn't similar in any respect from patient to patient. He said, and this began a process of thought about, well, what are we talking about when we talk about the mind? He had already reached the conclusion, as had I, that the mind was not the brain, that it was involved with energies, but they were not neurochemical energies. They were energies that infiltrate and surround the body, like fields. But what is the mind actually doing? And so with more research, he came to the following conclusion. That the mind presents patterns to people. And with each person, these patterns are different. They're patterns of images. They are what Jack liked to call frequently landscapes. Well, here I am, and this is what I'm seeing, you know. And again, from patient to patient, these descriptions were radically different. In many cases, they were really kinds of landscapes. Well, I'm sitting in a field of flowers, and I'm looking at the sky, and there's a castle off to the left, and there are trees, it's a forest, and there's a river that runs. You know, where is this stuff coming from? What is it? This is what patients are reporting when under hypnosis they're asked to look and essentially look into their minds and report what they see. Patterns of images, landscapes, templates, Jack sometimes called them. And these templates suggest to the person whose mind it is options for their future. What can happen? What good things can happen? What are the limits of those things? The mind tends to arrange itself in these templates or patterns as if the mind is trying to figure out what is the best possible future for this person. So it's running its processes using imagery, using sometimes sound, sometimes verbal statements, but largely imagery, And the connection between the imagery and the suggested future, or the parameters of a future, are not always a one-to-one correspondence. In fact, usually they're not. It's not something, oh, well, here's a pattern of me living in a house with a picket fence and a driveway and 2.2 children and wife and blah, 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 blah. No. It's not usually that literal. It's more of a kind of suggestion, a sense of where the ceiling on the future is, where the ceiling lies. And Jack became intensely interested in this because if you could change that, if you could change the landscapes that the mind presents, the patterns of images, the templates of possible futures, more than one, you see, it's the parameters. You could go here, you could go there, if you could go here, you could also possibly go there, you know, there. You know. A range of possible futures. If you could change all of this in some way, then you would change possibly the person's own appreciation of what the future can bring, of how marvelous it could be, of how limitless it might be, etc., etc. In other words, you would awaken in the person desires for the future that he didn't even know he had, because he was limited by consulting his eternal guide, which is the mind, to provide suggestions and templates about his own future and what it can be. So that was the kind of problem that Jack posed for himself, the challenge, how to work with patients in ways that will change what the mind is presenting. And so you can see that from his findings, this was not as if the mind is presenting a straight list of beliefs. I believe this, I believe that, I believe this, I believe that, or a straight list of thoughts. I think this, I think that, I think this, I think that. It was not so specific and not so literal, but it was powerful. And as you can imagine, I'm sure, sometimes the indirect method of suggestion by imagery and so forth is the more powerful. And in this case, it certainly was. So Jack began to devise strategies for working with patients to change all of this. And at first, he was using traditional hypnosis. That is, he would put people into a light trance, and then he would ask them to do certain things, such as recount a dream that they had while asleep, invent a dream that they never had, all kinds of little things to provoke some sort of response. He knew not what. Jack was not sure where it was going to go. And eventually he discarded the whole notion of traditional hypnosis. He would sometimes still put people in a light trance, sometimes no trance at all. And what he came upon was the following. If you could get a person to imagine in a wide enough range, the mind itself would begin to change. That was a major kind of proposition. It was a hypothesis that had, as you can guess, far, 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 far-reaching consequences. If you can get a person to imagine, and notice that we're not talking about imagine along a particular line, about a particular subject, but just in general, imagine widely enough, over a far enough range, his mind will begin to change. What the mind presents now to the person will begin to change. So we're looking at sort of three elements here: the person himself, the mind, and the imagination. And so Jack began to work in an area that was already familiar to me because I had been a painter for many, many years and had seen on a very personal and up-close way how creating paintings could change my life entirely. So the first thing I said to Jack is, well, I would expect that when you're doing this with patients, the first thing that happens is that their perception of the present is going to change. He said, absolutely. That's what he was discovering in nearly a one-on-one basis. So when I began a serious consulting practice with private clients about 15 or 20 years ago, this became one of the bases of that practice. The first effect of broadly imagining this, imagining that, imagining this, imagining that, is a change in perception of the present. How so? The present tends to become more congenial. It seems to be more elastic. It seems paradoxically to be more intimate and yet at the same time more objective. It seems to be more uplifting, more positive. It seems to be more inviting, shall we say. It seems to be more malleable, more changeable. In some cases, it seems to be more lucid, even to the extent of improving eyesight. And the so-called negative sensations having to do with the environment and what's outside you and reality and so forth seem to diminish considerably. It's not that you then develop some sort of crazy Pollyannist view that everything is wonderful all the time, no matter what's happening, you know, that sort of thing. No, it's quite balanced. In the sense, there is a great equilibrium and centering about all of this. So Jack and I began to compare notes on techniques and exercises of the imagination that he was using with patients. And I said to him at one point, you know, it doesn't seem to matter that much. You say to a person, okay, I want you to imagine that the table that's sitting here in the room is actually a forest. I want you to imagine that the window is actually an automobile. I want you to imagine that the trees outside the window are actually purple rather than green. I want you to imagine that they're upside down. I want you to imagine that the clouds in the sky are far, far, far lower than they appear, etc. These are just the, you know, right out of the gate, the very simple things. I want you to imagine that you're wearing gloves, that you're wearing heavy winter boots and a heavy winter coat. I want you to imagine that on the other side of that wall there is a vast cathedral. Etc., etc. Little harmless kinds of neutral things. And he agreed. He said, yeah, I found this to be so. Whether the person is in a light trance or in no trance at all, that if he can do these kinds of very simple little exercises, at some point, it could be quickly, it could take a while, it doesn't really matter, he begins to report changes in his life, in the present. You know, I'm feeling better when I'm waking up in the morning. I walk outside. I don't know. I just kind of have this loose feeling that different things are possible. I don't know which things, but I feel like that when I'm walking down the street. It's different now. It's different. Because why? Because why? And the obvious answer to that is because now we are taking the restrictive, restraining, tyrannical concept of one reality, indivisible, you know, within justice for all, and we're breaking that apart by introducing imagination, which of course creates, has the potential of creating other realities, if only in image form. a loosening up. People say, yeah, you know, I just feel more flexible. I feel more comfortable, more secure when I walk down the street. I see things more clearly, and at the same time, I feel that I can do more in the future. What that is, I don't know, but it feels quite real to me. The potential of multiple futures instead of one or two possible futures. The multiplication of multiple potential realities as opposed to just one reality takes a great deal of pressure off. It's like letting air out of something and relaxing it. Oh. You mean I've been believing some sort of strange subconscious belief in the one indivisible reality, whatever the heck that is, for years and years and years now, and all of a sudden now the sensation of multiple potential realities is entering in because I'm doing these imagination exercises. And so that seemed to be one of the first things that would happen to people. But then there would be another phase. And in that phase, indeed, the mind would begin to present to the person new imagery and new patterns of images and new templates, but new sensations and emotions connected with that imagery. When you stop and think about it, most imagery really is not neutral when you're talking about feelings. You have some feeling about it, an aversion, an attraction, or maybe you get happy when you see an image, or maybe you get kind of hostile, you know, whatever. There's a whole range of emotional responses that normally accompany images. And what Jack discovered with his patients was that now the mind, so to speak, was reporting to the person not only new imagery, but new kinds of imagery accompanied by new feelings and new emotions. And these new emotions were more open-ended, more uplifting, shall we say, but not in some sort of regimented way. Again, open-ended, lots of possibilities. Yeah, it feels good. Yeah, imagery suggesting futures that would be exciting, thrilling, adventurous, interesting, rewarding, happy, etc., 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 etc. And as the mind began to feed that to the person, that feedback loop would then create in the person an increased sense of optimism about the future. That was, you might say, the second phase. Although these phases are not ironclad, but for the purpose of discussion, it kind of falls out that way. And then the third phase would be that the person indeed would begin to discover, as if it had been lost for eons, desires about what the person wanted to do or achieve that had disappeared from his consciousness. Sometimes disappeared for months, a few years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, could go all the way back. And this was quite extraordinary. And this was happening to a number of Jack's patients. That with more and more exercises, shall we say, sessions which deployed imagination to do various things, some simple, some more complex, invent a dream you never had, and then flesh out the details of this invention. You know, okay, so what does the apartment look like where you were, and what color on the walls? And you have the person continue to invent a dream, and many dreams. Because you see, in dreams, there are no rules. There's no rules about space and time or energy or about how the storyline has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Suddenly a dream can chop off and you change location. You're now in a different place and different things are happening, but you go along with it in the dream. You can deal with it. You don't suddenly stop and say, this dream is not permitted to continue because it is out of sync with the way time and space are supposed to function. No, you go along with it. And so in inventing dreams, which are more complex tasks for imagination, now people really began to stretch out, really began to, you know, create, imagine events, situations, people, etc., on a scale that was unprecedented for them because there were no strictures and rules and regulations about time and space and energy, and things have to be a certain way, and a certain continuous sense has to be built into the whole thing. No, not at all. Not at all. As these patients were doing more and more complex, imaginative tasks, now old desires were resurfacing, and in some cases desires that had never been desires before were appearing. Big time desires. I don't mean like, yeah, I was painting my nails red, but now I want to paint them blue. No. Big desires that imply the future, that stretch out into the future, that involve work toward achieving that future and all the whole thing in a big, you know, big ball. And along with that, exhilaration on the part of the patient, and along with that, the influx of new energies that had not been present before, as if from some unknown fount or source, a directive was being unleashed. Supply this guy with tremendous energy because now he's really on the ball. Now he's really on the beam. Now he really is wrapping his mind and his arms around big time desires for the future. So he's going to need more energy, and give it to him right now. No delays. Make it real good, you know, sparkling energy. Deliver it now. Boom. There it is. That's what some of these patients were feeling. You know, all of a sudden, I had tremendous amounts of energy. All of a sudden, I felt unleashed. All of a sudden, I felt that I'd gotten out of jail. All of a sudden, I was able to not only see desires that I hadn't thought of in years or had never thought of before, but I could see and sense that I could accomplish these desires, and therefore the future that I would build would be entirely different than anything that I had conceived up to this point, including my most formerly optimistic projections about the future that I could attain. This is way bigger. Way bigger. Wow. The ceiling comes off. The ceiling comes off. I have to confess, I'm writing something down, because just as I've been talking about this, one of those big time desires that I forgot about suddenly flooded in. Yeah, that's the way it goes. So, Jack and I engaged in a great deal of dialogue, great many conversations, great many interviews about all these things. And so the conclusion was, yes, the mind plays a major role in creating your future, but what the mind is reporting to the person is the key. Because whatever the reports issued, so to speak, in terms of image, landscape, pattern, template, you know, that allude to the limits of the future, what possible futures can be and what therefore can't be, etc., etc. When all of that begins to change, when the mind now begins reporting new stuff, hey, we've got reports now that we've never had before, and here they are, that creates a feedback into the person which then allows these tremendous desires to resurface. And the person now looks not only at the present as being enhanced, but now we're really getting into tremendous energy when it comes to futures that can be created. So you see, a person can be satisfied. The person could say, you know, all in all, I'm pretty satisfied. There are a few things that I want that I don't have now. And if I could get them, including more money, then I would know what to do and I know the future that I want to create. Sure, that's true, absolutely. The big question, though, is if the person had those things, whatever they were, that he feels he needs, would the future that he then embarks upon creating really be the future that he really, 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 really wants or not? Or would it be a kind of compromised, whittled down version? And this is what I see many, many, many times with private clients that I work with. Yeah, they have an idea of the future and they're satisfied with it. But upon further, upon further investigation, what really turns out to be the case is that they're provisionally satisfied with those futures because what the mind, their minds are reporting to them are suggesting that this type of future is about as far as they can go. And so they're accepting that and saying, okay, yeah, that's pretty good. I'm reasonably happy with that. Yeah. Not thrilled, really thrilled, really thrilled big time. Maybe not. But satisfied. So what that means is that the law of diminishing returns is going to set in sooner or later, because the longer the person moves into that future which about which he's reasonably satisfied and happy, the further he builds out that future and lives in that future, the more he's going to discover, because it is now not just an idea or an image or vision, but it's turning into a reality, the more he's going to discover that this is not really as satisfying as he thought it was going to be. And that's a shame. I don't think that should be the case with people. I think it's a lot better to be able to get the capacity to experience a desire that is much, much bigger and more thrilling and passionate and exciting and energizing and inspiring earlier on, and then build that, because that is not subject to the law of diminishing returns. On the contrary, and this Jack and I had many conversations about, and I talked with a few of his patients about, what happens is that this kind of a future branches off into many sectors. It grows new pieces onto it that make it get even bigger and more thrilling and more exciting. So this is a completely different look at what one could call psychology, except that I don't call it that because the word psychology has been hijacked to mean a whole lot of things that don't really pay off, not in this sense. But if you had a real psychology, it would be along these lines. If you had a real study of mind, it would be along these lines. If you had a real study about people's goals and the future, it would be along these lines. It's like, imagine something like very tiny, very small, small, slightly larger again, medium size, getting bigger, somewhat bigger, very much bigger, huge, gigantic. If that were the ladder of desires, and you were climbing that ladder, if you knew that that was the way the ladder worked and what it consisted of, you would want to get to the top. But if somehow what your mind was reporting to you translated into halfway up the ladder is the limit, that's where you're going to make your stand, and that's where you're going, as everybody does, to rationalize that stand and to say, this is a good place to be, and this is the best place to be for me, and this is where I am, this is where I'm going to stay, and this is what I'm doing, and blah, 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 blah. And do you believe that? Yes. On a certain level, you believe that. But on a much deeper level, that is not the case. Simply not the case. Reasonably good, pretty good, okay, nice, satisfying. Those are not the limits. Not the limits. So then we come to this question, as Jack did, because he found certain patients that made all of these breakthroughs and discoveries that I'm talking about, and yet they still wanted to settle for the mid space on the ladder. You know, still wanted to. And in that case, back to the drawing board, what is the mind continuing to report to the person that allows that person, even though they've had all the breakthroughs, to still be determined to stay in what they can fulfill for themselves and those they love at the midpoint of the ladder rather than at the top? Why don't they want to keep climbing? And so work further with these patients revealed that what the mind was reporting was something on the order of, if it's too good, it might be dangerous. If it's too fabulous and too thrilling and too exhilarating and too glorious, there might be something hidden there that is not okay. There were still remaining templates delivered from the mind to the person along these lines that I'm suggesting now. Yes, we're not doubting now that there are great things that potentially are in store for you and so forth and so on, but realize at the same time, this could be dangerous. Could be too big. Maybe at a certain level of expansion, it's going to be too big. And now you are in a whole new venue of the mind reporting to the person in certain ways that limit that person. But it's at a whole new level. And it has to do with success, number one, and two, power. And I'll take these up one at a time. Jack and I also spent many hours with patients who had volunteered in experimental work to get to this new level of breakthrough. Success. There are certain patterns, imagery, templates delivered by the mind to the person that beyond a certain level of success, things might become too exposed, for example. Oh, I might be then too exposed because then people would know about me, and if then people knew about me, then maybe some bad things would happen to me because whether these are realistic expectations or not is not the issue here. What the issue is that there is this sub voce, you know, under the surface, reporting by the mind to the person delivering these templates, as I'm describing here, that the person is not really aware of. So it's not a matter of choice. Yeah, I think maybe too much success could be dangerous, and therefore I think I want to scale back to the middle of the ladder. or too much success could mean that I would become too responsible. And being too responsible, you know, one can make mistakes. And if one makes bad mistakes, then things could crumble and the whole thing could come crashing down. Whereas if I just stay in the middle ground of future, of success, I'll be much better off. That's another template. Those are two major ones. Dangerous, too much exposure. Or things, the third one was, things could get out of control. Things would be so successful, you see, that I wouldn't be able to view my entire, you know, empire, so to speak. Things would be going on that would be completely out of my control, and then things could happen that I wouldn't know about, and they could come back to rebound on me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People could do things that I don't know about. People who are associated with me or who work for me, et cetera, et cetera. Out of control. Things could get out of control. Things could be dangerous, things could be exposed, and things could be out of control. And then when we go to power as the other major template, now we're really getting into some gory stuff, fabulous stuff, really. Well, if I had power more than this, whatever this is, things could get sketchy, things could get strange, things could get kind of weird. Suppose I was really able to do things that now I'm absolutely not capable of doing, such as manifesting things because, you know, they fit with my future. Suppose that my abilities began to go beyond the normal range into the paranormal. Suppose that my power got to a certain point where I had never experienced it before. See, these are sort of, And the templates being delivered up by the mind in that case is, you know, I might end up doing bad things if I had so much power. That's a big one. Could end up doing bad things. Could end up making mistakes. You know, using the power for good, so to speak, but make a mistake and there are consequences that are suffered by myself and by other people. Could end up beyond the consensus. What would happen if that were the case? Suppose, you know, I had so much power that I ended up beyond the consensus. Now, whether or not, again, whether these are realistic reports being delivered by the mind is in a way beside the point. It's the fact that this information, if you will, these templates, patterns, images, landscapes, are coming through to the person. And in one case, we had, and this was in a light trance, this patient was reporting landscapes peopled by giants, you see, that seemed to have no relevance to anything, but it was just a different kind of a world, and there were these huge beings clotting around and so forth and so on. But eventually it began to be clear to the patient that what this was all about was really templates about power being delivered to him by his own mind. That these templates were saying, in effect, watch out, because, you see, you could become a giant, and look at these giants clotting around. They become kind of clumsy. They become awkward. They become ill-fitting. They don't fit into the landscape. They're too big, too noticeable. People take notice. They see, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You see. And so, scale back. Now, so Jack, and by this time we were really collaborating, and in my consulting practice, I work with this whenever it appears and crops up. How do you deal with this level of mind limiting the future? in terms of success and power, these two major things. And again, part of the job comes back to imagination. By continuing to increase the complexity of what imagination can invent and having people actually do this, they begin to experience a certain kind of intrinsic success and power in themselves, internally. And getting familiar with it and getting used to it makes them realize that they can deal with it. They can live with it. They can exercise it. They can use it without all of these attendant, without all of that stuff. Because, as it turns out, imagination is power. Imagination is power. Imagination is success. And this does vastly increase the ability to accept one's own power and therefore use it. So, as strange as it may seem, we can bring this back to the idea that with a limited amount of experience of imagination, a person is going to envision all kinds of problems out there in the future, potential problems. But as one becomes more adept and familiar with employing imagination over a wider range, those fears diminish and they go away. And what replaces them is a tremendous passion, enthusiasm, desire for a bigger future than one had ever supposed that he could create. It would take me much longer to spell out everything that I'm talking about here in great, great detail and tell the entire story, but this is enough of it to give you a sense of how the mind creates, how your mind creates your future, and what you can do about it. Everything in society, in civilization, and you can count this as being true of 99.999999 of all civilizations and societies from the beginning of time on Earth till now, have not been able to integrate the notion of the individual's own creative power and imagination. And therefore, through hook and by crook and by every other means, including non-intentional means, in other words, not with harm in mind, but simply because it's just too much to deal with and too big a mystery, civilizations and societies organize themselves around other principles than the individual's own creative power. They just do. And you can see this in America now, and in other countries now. I mean, these are now getting to be, at least in Earth terms, fairly advanced technological societies. And you can see to what degree they are now organizing, doing surveillance, trying to, you know, group people into categories and specializations and so forth and so on, all for the sake of the organization factor. You can see much more clearly, I would say, than even in the past, how the whole notion of the individual and therefore individual imagination has been ruled out of the formula and the equation because people just don't see how to fit it in. They don't really. They might give lip service to it. They might make ads about it. They might do all kinds of things, but they really don't get it. They really don't see it. And not seeing it, life as we experience it around us becomes organized without that creative power factor. And one of the reasons that I began a consulting practice all those years ago was because I wanted to see things on an individual level. I wanted to work with individuals because that's when you come back to, that's where the rubber meets the road. What is that person's perceived limitations? Where is that person vis-a-vis his own imagination? What can be done to increase the scope and the power of it so that all of a sudden you begin to see that person reassessing their life and future in much greater terms, grander terms, happier terms, more satisfying and joyous terms? That's where you see it happening at the level of the individual. That's where I wanted to go. I could spend more time on this, but I think it's a good place to end off for now. It's very exciting material. I was deeply inspired by working with Jack True all those years ago and discovering that we had many things in common, coming at it from different angles. I was coming at it from being a writer and a painter, and he was coming at it from being a real innovator in the field of hypnotherapy. And the meeting ground was generated a tremendous amount of energy, conversation, interview, and knowledge. And I carry on in that tradition with, you know, taking what I learned from all of that and making it work here and now. There were other individuals, some of whom I've described in my writing and some not, who provided similar inspiration. But the interesting, fascinating thing about all of them is that it all eventually shook out into the same territory. That is, the inspiration was really around this notion of creative power. What can you create? What do you truly want to create? The future is the place where you create it. You make the future. Okay, John Rappaport for the Solari Report. Happy holiday season. Happy New Year. See you next year.